Case number 2016-60, Joseph Stanislaw et al. Versus Thetford Township, Michigan et al. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Weininger, you may proceed for the appellants.
Thank you. May it please the court, Daniel Weininger on behalf of the appellants in this case. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Fine.
The district court's decision in this case rests upon a fundamental misconception. And that is, the district court applied Michigan res judicata principles in this case, when in actuality, federal res judicata principles apply in this case. Federal law and Michigan law in this respect on res judicata are diametrically opposed to one another. If we look at this court's precedents in Rao and in Kane and Celador Productions, a trifecta, the governing standard is that allegations that arise after the filing of the complaint may be a part of a subsequent action. They need not be supplemented in the initial proceeding. That is diametrically opposed to what the Michigan standard is, which is what the district court applied in this case when it followed Buck versus Thomas Cooley Law School. In Buck versus Thomas Cooley Law School, that was strictly a Michigan res judicata case. And in Michigan, under Michigan law, and the Michigan Supreme Court held this way in Adair v. State, there is a duty. There is a clear obligation under Michigan law. Unless you want to be precluded by res judicata, there's a clear obligation to supplement your complaint when subsequent allegations arise. And I want to be clear for the panel. There is no such duty under federal law. And I believe Judge Moore, I believe you authored the opinion in Rao. But Rao is not only the governing standard in the Sixth Circuit. It is the governing standard across the board in almost every circuit in this country. And it was endorsed most recently in Whole Woman's Health by the Supreme Court of the United States. So we have a situation where not only did the district court apply the wrong law, it also applied the wrong law incorrectly, because Michigan law says you only have a duty to supplement in a pending action. Once the action is completed through a judgment or a dismissal order, you no longer have the obligation under Michigan law to supplement the complaint. And in this case, the Stanislaws, the first action terminated in October of 2010. They had to then reapply for municipal and zoning approval in December of 2010, and the approval was denied in February of 2011. They had to do that to comply with the first district judge's order back in 2010, because the law at that time was that, Judge Rogers, I'm sorry, I can't.
Judge Rogers, your mute is on.
Oh, is he? I'm sorry, is he? Okay.
Yeah, Judge Rogers, your mute is on.
Got it, thank you. Could I interrupt and ask a question?
Sure.
This argument about supplementation, is that in your brief? I'm looking for it.
It is. The argument is under the heading of Buck. And we argued there that the defendants argued that, well, the federal standard and the Michigan standard are the same. We argued in our reply brief addressing that, saying, no, they're not the same. And here are the reasons.
Oh, it's in your reply brief then.
No, it's all, and it's also, Buck is also mentioned in our initial brief, where we said that the district court applied the wrong law. They applied Michigan res judicata.
Well, I understand, but you're making a point about the specifically about how the law is different, talking about the ability to supplement claims, and therefore res judicata applies differently, because you could have supplemented the claim in the earlier action. So therefore, the later facts still apply. That's the nature of your argument, right?
That's the nature of your argument. And
that's only in your reply brief, though.
It had to be, because we were addressing the defendant's argument that, hey, the two standards are the same. And we were saying, no, they're not the same, because under federal law, there's an identity prong, which does not appear under Michigan law. And that's really the crux of where the supplementation issue, why there's a differential. There's an identity prong under federal law. There's not an identity prong under Michigan law.
So is that about supplementing? Is that in your reply brief then?
The supplementation should be in the reply brief, and it specifically deals with Buck on the identity issue, where we distinguish the two standards.
There isn't much of a problem, though, is there, in that the first case am I correct, was filed in 2009?
Correct.
And you just said the first case ended in October of 2010. So even if there were a supplementation duty, which I'm not suggesting there is, but even if there were, even under Michigan law, that duty would end in October of 2010. And so the key then is, Raw, of course, said that federal law applies if the first case was in federal court as a diversity case and the second case is a diversity case or federal question case here. And so under Raw, what about the problem that some of the allegations in the complaint mention the year 2005, which clearly precedes the filing of the first case?
Sure. The reason why we had to include allegations regarding 2005 is because our inverse condemnation claim in this case extends back 15 years under Michigan law. So in order to have those allegations come in, they are still relevant to our inverse condemnation claim because those claims under Michigan law go back 15 years. So that's why 2005 is there. And 2005 is also there is also because under this court's precedence and under United States Supreme Court precedent, we are freely permitted to bring, in this case, pre-2009 conduct and establish a pattern in our case, which is strictly post-2011, anything from February 22nd, 2011 on. We're freely permitted to do that. Granted, we cannot recover. I want to be clear for the panel. We cannot recover on the equal protection claim. We cannot recover on any of the allegations from 2005 through 2009. Those claims on the equal protection front are gone. But we can use allegations and facts that we've learned in discovery that occurred from 2005 through 2009, and then use them to support our equal protection claims that extend from 2011 until 2017, where the ZBA completely reversed its position and said, hey, these restrictions we've had, they've never existed. So that's where those allegations can come into play. And that's also why 2005 is the allegations are there. But more importantly, to address that point, in Kehu versus SES Analytics in 2019, this court addressed that very specific argument that defendants raised, which is that, oh, hey, there's mention of 2005 in here. Kehu versus SES Analytics specifically addressed this argument. And they said, the panel said, you need to look at the entire complaint. That's how you establish plausibility. The entire complaint is examined. You just don't narrowly focus on the specific cause of action that's the subject of the plausibility analysis.
Counsel, could I ask another question?
Of course.
You've been talking about the binding effect of the previous decision, whether that exists or not. What about the alternative argument of the district court on the merits?
The district court on the merits, first of all, the defendants never raised the plausibility argument. The court addressed that strictly on its own volition, sua sponte. And when that happens, under this court's clear precedence from Apple, Wagenknecht, we'll disregard its two obligations in that regard. If the district judge is going to dismiss something sua sponte, they have to either A, let the party know that I've identified a plausibility issue with your complaint and show me why I'm wrong. So it's almost like a show cause order. Or two, give us leave to amend. Otherwise, you have a situation where what the district court judge did here, which is essentially dismissal through ambush. We never had the opportunity to address.
But you have the opportunity now to say what's wrong with it.
We certainly do. And
you'd rather have that opportunity in the district court than in our court.
It's not that I prefer it. I think that's pretty much the way Sixth Circuit case law says, is that the district court should be addressing these issues. Not the appellate court in the first instance. But even that being said, Judge Rogers.
Sometimes we affirm on alternative grounds and that with varying degrees of the extent that it was raised below. And sometimes that involves, you know, how clear the law is and so forth.
Sure.
I'm not sure the law is as crisp as you describe it. Maybe it is.
I would just.
That's my concern. Seems to me to be the weaker part of your argument, really.
I would say this. If we look at the 12B6/12C analysis, all the allegations must be construed in our favor, not the defendant's favor. And also, the entire complaint must be analyzed for the plausibility analysis. and we've clearly established who the comparators are, what the factors are, what elements each comparator has.
And how is this different from an ordinary run-of-the-mill state law arbitrary and capricious review of agency action when you get to that point?
There is no agency action here. That's number one. But number two, we have an equal protection.
Wait a minute. I thought you were complaining about what the township was doing.
Right. What the township is doing, obviously, I mean, there's
that's a government agency, right? That's doing something to you and you're seeking relief, right? Normally that would go through state administrative law. You say, well, they abused their discretion when they denied us this license or whatever it was, right?
But here we have to bring the case in. Well, we brought in state court because of
shouldn't it be in state court? Now you can say, well, they never raised that, but.
Well, they're the ones who removed.
But I think we have to be a little careful about taking run-of-the-mill state law administrative claims that the agency or the township or whatever the state government actor did was unreasonable. It normally would go under state law to determine whether it's arbitrary and capricious. Instead, we have this not frequently used, really, category of one or case of one equal protection claim. It looks like kind of a little bit manipulative way of getting into federal court. Now, May, you didn't originally want to be in federal court in the first place, but it would seem like you'd have to interpret equal protection analysis pretty broadly to say that an erroneous denial of a license to conduct this kind of business is a federal claim as opposed to a state claim.
Well, Judge Rogers, let me be clear on our allegations. We're not alleging that there was some sort of procedural foul up at the Zoning Board of Appeals.
I'm not talking about a procedural foul up. I'm talking about a substantive review of state agency action.
If a state agency did what the township did in this case, which is make up the law, because the law doesn't exist, then you have a clear violation of equal protection based on class of one, which the Supreme Court has endorsed for 20 years.
So every time they violate the law and they don't violate the law with respect to somebody else, it's a federal case. They violate the state law.
If there's no rational basis for the decision, which in this case there isn't, then the Supreme Court, not me, the Supreme Court has said there is.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I think your time is up, and so you can have your rebuttal time.
Thank you.
Mr. Rady, am I pronouncing it right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Your turn.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Christopher Raiti on behalf of the defendants, Thetford Township, Mark Angus, Dennis Bloss, Luther Hatchett, Robert Swartwood, and Stuart Worthing. Your Honors, just to jump right in, it's important to recall or remember that we're here on a motion for judgment on the pleadings. So the facts, as Mr. Weininger was discussing, are really not pertinent. What we're looking at is what's in the complaint and what documents are referenced in the complaint or public documents. So they would include the decisions of the Eastern District of Michigan from Stanislaw 1, as well as this court's decision in 2013 affirming the previous dismissal. During his presentation, Mr. Weininger urged the court to look at the complaint as a whole and not just focus on the 2005 date. And I did that. I looked at it as a whole. Throughout every complaint count alleged, plaintiffs do not allege that certain action stems from conduct in 2011. Each one of them says since 2005. So if we're to accept plaintiff's proposition that what they really meant was that their claims arose in 2011, well, I suppose that should have been pled, but it wasn't. What we're left with is what's in the complaint. And again, there are no less than at least 8 or 9 references in the specific counts of the complaint that their allegations began in 2005.
If there were continuing events that were distinct events that happened, but a part of a pattern, would those events that happened hypothetically, I'm going to make up a date, in 2015, would they be barred by claim preclusion from being raised in a new case?
Well, that's an interesting question, Your Honor, and it's a little bit unclear. The case that Mr. Weininger's relying on certainly say that new allegations or new claims that arise after the conclusion of litigation are not barred. But that's not what we have in this case. In this case, what we have is new evidence of the same violation or the same allegation.
So, well, I thought there were new acts that the township undertook. The various members of the town, I'm going to use township broadly so I don't have to get into people, but that the township had denied various subsequent permits and had told the Stanislaus various things that they had to do, and that those things happened subsequent to 2010 when the first case was resolved at the district court.
It is true that they did reapply after the 2010 decision. However,
and then they reapplied and they didn't get what they wanted. So how could that decision subsequent to 2010 be barred by a case that was decided in 2010?
Because it's just a repeat. It's an extension of what happened in what was alleged in the 2010 in Stanislaus 1. So the court in the Tohono, I think it's Tutelum, I can never pronounce it properly. It's a Native American case. The Supreme Court says we look at the factual overlap of the two cases, and we look for a comparison. So even though they're not exact, it is the same core operative facts. As Mr. Weininger explained, he's looking at all of the conduct. So the conduct, according to the complaint, again, this is a motion for judgment on the pleadings, begins in 2005. So if the claim was that really that the offensive conduct that they were alleging began in 2011, I suppose that's what the complaint should have said, but that's not what the complaint says. What it's alleging is exactly what was alleged in Stanislaus 1. And the law says we look to the core facts to decide both of these, and there is clear overlap. So much so to make these the same case. It's as the district court said, this is not new allegations. This is successive litigation trying to remedy the deficiencies of Stanislaus 1. In Stanislaus 1,
wouldn't it have been strange to write an opinion that or write a complaint that just started in 2011, say? Wasn't there a tremendous amount of background that you would have to include to give any sense to what's going on for the current dispute?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
We can't penalize the plaintiff for that.
Well, we're not, Your Honor, but what we are doing is holding them to their pleadings. And if you refer to the complaint, throughout the complaint, in every single complaint count, they don't allege that the conduct began in 2011 for the equal protection claim. They say since 2005. So,
they also have a section, for instance, second denial of zoning approval, which talks about Angus denying applications on February 23rd, 2011. So they're, and I'm just picking that one paragraph out. There are many paragraphs that pick out things that happened in 2011, 2012, et cetera. So if hypothetically different reasons were given by Angus at different times or by different people at different times than had been given prior to 2009, why shouldn't the Stanislaus be able to bring a new complaint raising these new reasons that they were denied and say those reasons violate the X, Y, and Z laws?
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, that would be reforming the claims in the complaint. Now, I concede that there are some factual allegations that arise after 2009. However, had Stanislaus truly meant that their claims arose in 2011, then they wouldn't have named somebody like Luther Hatchett, who was no longer there in 2011. They wouldn't have named the people who weren't there as people who should be held to the equal protection claim. And that's
really isn't your remedy for that problem to move to dismiss the complaint vis-a-vis Hatchett, who did nothing after 2010, hypothetically?
Well, Your Honor, we did ask for that in the alternative. And
But the question, you know, the basic question is, under Raw, wasn't the district court wrong to use res judicata, claim preclusion, to preclude subsequent actions that the Stanislaus claim violated their rights?
Your Honor, I agree. I concede that, or agree that there, that respectfully, no. And that is because this is simply an extension of the claims in Stanislaus 1. Alternatively, if the court feels otherwise,
counsel, I understand. I think we understand your position as well as we're going to right now on that issue. I'm wondering if we can move to the for you hypothetical world that you lose on that. There's no collateral estoppel problem here. It does seem like a similar case. And in the previous case, they didn't throw it out on collateral estoppel. They threw it out on failure to state a plausible claim. And the district court here relied in the alternative, did it not, on failure to assert a plausible claim?
Right? Yes, Your Honor.
But opposing counsel says we can't rely on that, A, because you didn't make that argument to the district court, and therefore they never got a chance to oppose it. And B, I think that you don't even argue it in your brief before us.
No, Your Honor, I believe we did argue it in our brief.
Did argue the merits of it in your briefs, all right?
Yes, Your Honor. So
why should we now decide something to affirm the district court below when counsel didn't have a chance to object below, although you say they did have a chance to object here? Object is the wrong word. Give us reasons for why it shouldn't.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, this is a de novo review. And so it is as if we're filing the motion for judgment on the pleadings before you now. And obviously this was raised in our brief. Counsel raised it here before the court, why they believe that their claim should go forward. But the law is the law.
His objection is that, with respect, his objection is that he didn't have a chance to argue this to the district court in the first place. So would you have any objection if we disagree with you on the res judicata issue, to send this back and say, district court, see if you agree after the other side provides the argument that you never gave it the chance to provide? Or is that just a waste of time?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that Your Honor, in this case, because this is a de novo review of a motion for judgment on the pleadings, I believe this court certainly has the authority to affirm the dismissal on any of the alternative grounds, including the 12B6 grounds.
Even if the other side had no chance below to respond to them, because it had a chance at the appellate level to respond to them. Do you have cases that support that?
I do not, Your Honor. I don't have that.
Well, if you come up with one, send it to us.
Yes, sir.
You understand what I'm asking?
I do, Your Honor, I do. But to your point about 12B6, Your Honor, to meet the standard, the plaintiff has to contain enough factual matter to plausibly show that there was not any conceivable basis that rationally supported the alleged disparate treatment. In this case,
arguably, they'd need to show what these other four companies, what the circumstances was with respect to the other four companies.
Right. How they were similarly situated and how they were treated better or worse beyond just.
Otherwise, you don't really have a class of one equal protection claim. You just have an arbitrary and capricious review of agency action kind of claim under state law.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
I got it. Thank you.
So really, so to summarize, Your Honor, there's three main issues here in this case. Could the issues that are being litigated now have been litigated in Stanislaus 1? And certainly there is an identity of claims that arose, significant factual overlap. So there is the identity between Stanislaus 1 and Stanislaus 2 that counsels for endorsing or affirming the district court decision to dismiss on collateral estoppel and issue preclusion reasons. Secondarily, or third, rather, as Judge Rogers pointed out, whether or not plaintiffs have stated a viable claim or a plausible claim. And in this case, because they have not included any allegations about how these comparators were similarly situated, how they were treated differently, for those reasons, plaintiff has failed to state a viable claim.
On that last point, yes, in the complaint, paragraphs 57 and 58, and I guess it goes on a little bit more, they mention the names of the four similarly situated used automobile dealerships and or repair facilities, say that they've continuously operated, say that the township did not require these entities to maintain fencing, did not deny their zoning approval forms, did not obstruct their business. What more do you want?
Well, we need to know what those businesses are, and how they are similar.
He tells us the names and he tells us what they do. What do you mean? What more do you need?
Well, under class of one, this is a rational basis standard. So we have to look if there's any conceivable reason that the township could treat these other alleged comparators differently, then it's not an equal protection violation. And along those lines, in order to make that analysis, plaintiffs have to set forth how these businesses are similarly situated. Throughout the brief, plaintiffs claim that these dealerships, their dealership, very specifically about their dealership. Well, we've got to compare it to these others as well and understand.
I guess what I wonder is, why isn't that something that you would put in your answer to the complaint, and then there would be discovery about or presentation of affidavits or other things that would give more detail. But I guess I wonder what you're saying then, that there needs to be a paragraph about each of these entities and exactly what permits they got and exactly all the details. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's not what I'm saying, Your Honor. That's what the state of the law is that to state a plausible claim, plaintiffs have to explain how they were similarly situated to these other comparators, as well as how or why they may have been treated differently, and establish that there was no justification for the disparate treatment or the alleged disparate treatment.
Doesn't the case law say in all relevant respects? So wouldn't we expect the complaint to identify what those relevant respects are and precisely articulate them so you can assess what your response is going to be? I mean, this is a unique area of law where we have pretty high burden on a plaintiff trying to put forward a claim.
Yes, Your Honor. You summarized it better than I would, the way that I was trying to. There is a high burden on the plaintiff to establish this criteria for a class of one OLEC claim. I see my time has expired.
Is there a case that you would point us to support your position here?
Well, yes, Your Honor. The standard is articulated that I was discussing in Rapp v. Dutcher, which is 557 Federal Appendix 444 from 2014.
Can you say the name of that case again? I'm sorry, I missed it.
It's Rapp with two P's, R-A-P-P. Mm-hmm. This is Dutcher, D-U-T-C-H-E-R.
Thank you. Thanks very much. I see your time is up, so thank you. And Mr. Weininger, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Your mute is on, sir.
Sorry about that.
No problem.
The last point about what Mr. Eti was saying with respect to the plausibility and factual sufficiency, that runs headlong and contrary to Supreme Court precedent in Leatherman and Swierczewski. And we cited to that in our brief. If you take a look even at what the Supreme Court said in Leatherman, verbatim, the federal rules of civil procedure do not require a claimant to set out in detail the facts upon which he bases his claim. To the contrary, all the rules require is a short, plain statement of the claim that will give the defendant fair notice of what the plaintiff's claim is and the grounds upon which it rests. If Mr. Eti had such a hard time understanding what our allegations were, why didn't he move for a more definite statement? why didn't he move under 12 under plausibility and factual sufficiency in the district court? And we've gone through discovery in this case. He was able to sufficiently answer the complaint.
You have gone through discovery in this case?
A year and a half.
Uh-huh. So, but the basic point that you had made earlier was if this were a problem, given that it wasn't raised by the defendants, it was raised sua sponte by the district court. If there is a pleading problem, you should be on notice of it and be able to at least seek to amend your complaint or to respond to what the concerns that the district court had about the sufficiency of the complaint.
Correct. Otherwise, it's dismissal through ambush, and your precedents in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure don't allow for that. But even putting that argument aside and going just straight to the heart of the matter, whether there is plausibility and factual sufficiency, so that Rule A2 and Rule 12B6 component of this, we have satisfied that. And I particularly point the court to the allegations in our complaint, paragraphs 56 through 61. I mean, we've delineated by name who these comparators are, what they do, and what the township did or did not do with respect to those businesses that were similarly situated and they did not do.
Mr. Weininger, agencies all the time will sometimes grant a license to one person and not to another person, even though there are some aspects of the two licenses that are similar.
But
and under ordinary administrative law, that may be an abuse of discretion. But under class of one, as I understand, it's got to be something that is without rational basis as a constitutional matter.
Yeah, Judge Rogers.
Which is an extremely deferential kind of distinction. Could they rationally, not was it wise or did they take the proper things into account, but could they rationally have given the license to one person rather than the other? It seems to me to say that there's no rational basis for allowing one of these companies to continue in business while you're not allowing this person to continue in business. You got to have a little bit more than they're in the same business.
Judge Rogers,
that's the way it strikes me. I don't know. Maybe my understanding of class of one is incorrect.
Judge Rogers, our allegations here are pretty extreme. And I've actually litigated a lot of these cases and I've never had one like this. The township made up the law. And I would encourage the panel, look at ordinance number 78 from Thetford Township. The criteria they were using to...
Well, making up the law is not a violation of class in one, as long as they apply that made up law consistently.
If you make up... Yeah, but if you make up the law and then don't apply consistency and both those...
So it's not whether it made up the law, it's whether it applied consistency. And that's what I say. And it's got to be consistent. It's the only consistency norm under class of one, as I understand it, is rational basis, which is about as deferential as you get these days.
But again,
is there a rational basis? You know, was it irrational? Was it crazy? You know?
Well, it is crazy if you make up the law and then only apply that made up law to one business. I mean, and those are the allegations in our complaint. We obviously are entitled to discovery. We have had discovery to prove whether that's true or not. But you must look at our complaint in our favor and judge the entire complaint and construe it in our favor. And those are our allegations.
That's not exactly. You have the obligation to satisfy the pleading standard in Iqbal and Twombly and other cases. The Supreme Court has raised the bar a bit. But you agree that the test is similarly situated in all relevant respects, correct?
Yeah, it's substantively on the class of equal protection. We have no problem with that. Our issue is that the Supreme Court has said in Leatherman and Swierczewiec that, yes, obviously you have Iqbal and Twombly, but there's no heightened pleading standard for these cases. And that's exactly what the Supreme Court said in Leatherman, which was a 1983 case.
I guess the point I was just making is that you presumably have to explain what some of those relevant respects are in your complaint so that the government agency is just saying that it's a competitor isn't enough. I think these are the questions Judge Rogers was getting at. If you had to amend the complaint, you could surely add that detail now, correct?
Of course, yes. Judge Whaley, you're absolutely right on that. If by some chance this court did remand, we would ask for leave to amend if the district court felt that it was necessary.
Thank you. Your time is up as well. Thank you both for your argument, and the case is submitted.